Please silence all electronic devices.
It seems to me that it would be awfully difficult to move an event this size to another venue in this amount of time.
I actually agree with just about everything Becky said. This is an enormously complex enterprise we're talking about here that's going to take all kinds of planning, even under the best of circumstances, enormously complicated. And now you add on the pandemic.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the unofficial Falls Lake Bureau, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. It is Friday. Time again to get caught up on the world. An interesting world, isn't it, of North Carolina politics. We'll be discussing some discussion over the Republican National Convention, still scheduled for Charlotte in just 3 months, as well as a couple of pieces of legislation, notable bills that moved this week at the General Assembly. Here for our review and conversation are Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from the progressive NC Policy Watch. Hey.
Hey there.
Afternoon.
Still socially distancing. We're recording early Friday afternoon. Several notable bills moved at the General Assembly this week. Let us begin with an election measure aimed at responding to the pandemic. It provides additional funding for holding elections and eases the ability to vote by mail. It was a compromise bill with wide bipartisan support. It was approved by the House and could be in the Senate as early as next week. How pleased were you to see this legislation receive approval this week?
It's a great start. It's very encouraging to see the General Assembly doing some bipartisan stuff. This is an incredibly important topic, how we manage to keep the elections going in a fair way this fall, with the pandemic presumably still in play. I share the concerns of a lot of the voting rights advocates that the bill has a lot of omissions, that we really should be doing much more to aggressively enable people to vote by mail, to protect poll workers, to spend more money on hiring a variety of poll workers. They've talked about this idea of contactless drop boxes and those are all things that we need to continue to, and of course, prepaid postage, making sure all the absentee ballots have prepaid postage. That's another one that ought to be a no-brainer. That said, it's great that we are making it easier to vote by mail. We've done away with, or made it easier to just have one witness. I think the idea of having one witness who then provides their address and identifying information is a great idea. That's better than having two who don't. So good start, but we're not quite there yet.
I thought it was so refreshing to see the House members working in tandem, working together, complementing each other. There was a lot of work that went into this, I think, behind the scenes. But, with the as much transparency as we can get under the circumstances, but certainly a lot of dialogue between lots of different parties. The State Board of Elections was involved in this. So I think Jeff, as you mentioned, just having the bipartisan support and folks working together, the final vote in the House was 116-3. And, we don't often see that kind of vote tally, particularly on something as contentious as elections. The other thing that really impressed me was it seemed like the debate and the discussion was really about solving the problem. We didn't hear some of the partisan discussions and, a lot of the rhetoric. It was more like, okay, what do we anticipate this is going to look like in November, and how do we solve these problems in a reasonable way? There was attention paid to tracking these absentee ballots, which I think is absolutely the right thing to do so that we ensure the integrity of those absentee ballots. And now that it goes over to the Senate, what we heard this week was that as these discussions were going on and the different factions of it were being worked out, again, to ensure that folks can vote during these really unprecedented times and to address the upcoming concerns that people have, the Senate was involved in some of those discussions. So, Jeff, you mentioned it could be over in the Senate as early as next week. We'll see what the discussion, and of course it'll go through the whole vetting process with committees and those kind of things. But it looks like we're on track to get this done and get this done early on in the legislative short session. And then, of course, with the certainty of what we're dealing with, the State Board of Elections and the different county elections can begin to put the pieces in place so that things are ready to go when early voting starts in, mid-October, right?
Sure. And provisional voting and some of those military ballots, those will be going out. Not looking at my calendar, but I'm fairly certain those begin to go out in September. Another bill to discuss, this one on The bar front, legislators approved a plan Thursday that would ease restrictions immediately for some food and drink establishments. Those businesses could utilize more outside seating in an effort to reach 100% capacity. Now, it passed overwhelmingly in the Senate, largely along party lines in the House. It's now before the governor, who has indicated he's leaning toward a veto. Why is this bill necessary right now, Becky?
Well, because you've got, you know, over 300,000 restaurant workers who are in limbo trying to get back on their feet. You've got thousands of small businesses, restaurants and bars, breweries, wineries, distilleries, all trying to get back up on their feet. And just things like expanding the outdoor seating can make or break the profit margin on some of these places. We heard from some members that represent coastal communities during the debate on this bill of, you know, their time frame in which their establishments make most of their money for the year are during the summer months as people vacation along the coast. The weather's nice. People want to sit outside to enjoy a meal or a drink. And so that's the emergency with it is, you know, we are on the, a lot of these small businesses are literally on the brink of going out of business. And this is a measure that would provide a lifeline for them. So we did see it move very quickly. It was interesting to me, too, that the Senate took it up first. The vote in the Senate was 42-5. There was a break with the House. The House took it went over to the House. Then the House took a break so that the different Republicans and Democrats could caucus, discuss the bill, which, of course, you know, I think that's a great idea to have more discussion on it. But the tone of the debate and then the vote in the Senate or in the House was much closer. It was 65-53 with only two Democrats voting in favor of it. So clearly something happened during that time frame that the bill was working its way through the General Assembly this week. But the immediacy to it is because you've got bars and restaurants and restaurant workers, bartenders, literally on the brink of being able to make their payments this month. That's the immediacy.
Well, I mean, to my way of thinking, the very fact that we're having this conversation right now and the way we're having it, socially distanced and not being in each other's presence, and the fact that the General Assembly continues to conduct much of its business in that way is, you know, concrete evidence of why this is moving too fast. We're having a spike right now in North Carolina and throughout the Southeast, indeed in some of the states that have already moved to reopen prematurely. We're starting to see the spike. There's other parts of the country are now not wanting to people to come from the Southeast because this is we've been moving too fast. We had 1,076 new positive cases and 32 deaths since yesterday. This is one of the highest totals we've had. And, you know, I can't for the life of me understand why we're going to I mean, I understand why people are worried about their businesses. I think workers have unemployment insurance, but I understand why people are concerned about their businesses. And it's a deep concern, but it's not to the level of hundreds of extra people dying, which is quite possibly what could happen. We really should be listening to the public health officials here rather than having essentially lobbyists and lawmakers draw up our public health laws.
Well, the efforts, though, for these people to open up are complying with the recommendations, with the social distancing, with wearing masks, all of those requirements that have been in place, only allowing a certain number of people within the establishments. I mean, they're doing this with those guidelines in mind. And as we open up other businesses, it just makes sense that these would be too. You know, right now you can go into a restaurant or a brewery, you can sit at a table, you can order a drink. All of a sudden, it's now too dangerous to sit down and go into a bar, sit at that same table and order a drink just because it's in a bar. You're not allowed to do it. I mean, you know, the longer this goes on, the more these provisions just do not make sense and they single out certain industries. And it's, you know, this still is the thing where people get to decide how they're going to, whether they're going to open their business up at all, or those that do want to do so under complying with the guidelines. And the more restrictions that the governor insists on putting in place with picking and choosing who can open and who can't, which quite frankly, in most cases, makes no sense. You know, we're going to continue to have these problems. Lawsuits have been filed against the governor in these cases. And Rob mentioned unemployment. You know, if you could get it, if the lines to get it, the mess at the unemployment office, and most people don't want it on unemployment. They want to work. They want to get back to work. They want to be able to provide for their families and for them and for themselves without, you know, depending on these government programs, particularly right now when it's just so convoluted and the efficiency of delivering those has become such a problem for so many people. They just want to get back to work, and they can do so safely, and the governor ought to allow them to do that.
Well, they clearly, if you talk about picking and choosing, let's look at this legislation and actually compare it to the CDC guidelines. CDC guidelines talk about social distancing, that's right, but the CDC guidelines talk about a whole raft of other requirements in terms of how the workers should be protected and how their temperature should be taken, and, you know, there's a long, long list. None of that's in this legislation. The reality is that this is going to put lots and lots of workers who would like actually to stay safe and to remain on unemployment insurance until it's safe to go back to work. It's going to force them to come back to work and put their lives at risk.
All right, let's move on. Last weekend, President Trump attempted to engage Governor Cooper on Twitter regarding the Republican National Convention. Remember, it's scheduled to take place in Charlotte in late August. The Cooper administration is currently seeking additional details from the Republican National Committee about what safety measures it plans to take, how the convention can safely happen, how big the crowd might be if it does take place. Becky, make the case for holding the RNC in Charlotte in less than 3 months.
I think the questions that are being asked about, you know, what are the safety precautions that are going to be in place? How is that going to work? How, you know, how can you protect workers? How can you protect those people coming to the convention that we're going to have from all over the country? I think those are reasonable questions to ask. A lot of the responses to that seem to be reasonable, too, with taking people's temperatures and requiring masks in certain parts and those kind of things. I mean, this back and forth, some of those things are still being clarified. I believe Mandy Cohen even sent a letter as recently as today asking for more clarification on some of those things. But one thing with these conventions and these big events that occur, these contracts are signed and worked out several years ahead of time. There's big investments that have already been made. A lot of this is in place. To put on an event like this, I understand, takes a lot of planning that can't be done just overnight. So one of the questions that I've had is, you know, less than 3 months before the occurrence of the convention, would another site be able to get everything in place in order to hold the convention? And you have the concerns about not just those with the pandemic that have come up and the coronavirus and the health issues, but with an event like that, it's the security that also comes into place. And again, that takes a lot of time to get all of those things into place. So just from a practical standpoint, from logistics, it seems to me that it would be awfully difficult to move an event this size to another venue in this amount of time.
I actually agree with just about everything Becky said. This is an enormously complex enterprise we're talking about here that's going to take all kinds of planning, even under the best of circumstances, enormously complicated. And now you add on the pandemic, you know, the situation changes day by day, week by week. The notion that this insane tweet from Trump is something that the governor should take seriously and respond to. This notion that, oh, you got to tell me in a week or, you know, yes or no, and I want it just like I want it, is preposterous. But of course, that's what we've come to expect from President Trump. His behavior, his erratic, irresponsible behavior has just gone on and on throughout this entire pandemic. And this is just the latest example of it. It embarrasses members of his own party, clearly members of his own staff, and puts them in an incredibly difficult position when these kinds of negotiations were already underway and were continuing and are going to need to continue. And it's just not clear whether the thing can actually be held safely. Certainly, there are real questions about having thousands of people in a hall standing shoulder to shoulder, as President Trump has indicated he wants. So, you know, Cooper's done the right thing. He's been very diplomatic. He said, we're going to let the health professionals figure this out. And let's hope that continues to be how it goes. But if I were the family member of an emergency room physician or a frontline worker in Charlotte, I'd be very worried about thousands of people coming to the city without proper precautions.
And then, of course, there's the issue of people going back across the country, right? I mean, there's the congregating of, you know, it could be 50, 60, 70,000 people, and then all of those folks dispersing and going back to their homes throughout the United States, which is another concern from public health officials that we've heard.
Right. That's a concern, you know, as well. But I think that, you know, the governor needs to be reasonable in what the expectations are. The other factor with this that I think, you know, we can't leave this topic without talking about the economic impact that this will have in Charlotte and, you know, much needed. We talked earlier in this segment about restaurants and bars and whether or not they're going to be open. Now, all of that hopefully will be settled by that time so that we can have full capacity for restaurants and bars and hotels and other activities that convention goers and take advantage of. The economic boom that this could be to Charlotte and to North Carolina's economy, in this time with the shutdown of businesses for months and months, this could just be critical. This could be the game changer for the restaurants, the bars, the tourism, the lodging in the Charlotte area, and a huge shot in the arm for North Carolina's economy that we desperately need.
The only thing that would harm the economy more is to have another dramatic spike in infections. And that is going to be even worse for the economy than taking our time.
We'll conclude with a story about harassment. State Senator Erica Smith is speaking out about what she describes as a hostile culture at the legislature. She made allegations of verbal harassment and assault. A legislative ethics committee, which we should note meets in relative secrecy and has for decades, dismissed her allegations last week. Now, multiple stories in recent years have exposed specific examples, and talking about other instances and other eras at the legislature, but specific examples and a larger culture of harassment on West Jones Street. Still, there have not been any significant reforms. What processes need to change?
Well, you know, I think even Representative Jackson, the minority leader, back in 2018, when we did our story at NC Policy Watch about the lawmaker, Representative Dwayne Hall, who was ultimately lost his seat because of allegations of sexual harassment, it was raised at that time there was no good, transparent way for a person to complain about this and to get some sort of thorough vetting of it. All we got after the Hall incident was the Paul Koble announcing that he was going to send around a video to all the members of the General Assembly and urge them to watch it. That was basically all that happened. And it's crazy that we have a secret process where lawmakers judge themselves like this. We need an independent and, I think, transparent process where people can bring these legitimate complaints forward. This is an enormously serious matter. We're moving in this direction in workplaces across the world that we're going to take these more seriously, and it's an embarrassment that the General Assembly doesn't do that.
I don't disagree at all that, you know, we need a better process. We need a process that ensures proper conduct. You would think that it would not be needed with elected officials and people who were being held accountable by their voters in their districts, but that's not true, unfortunately. And I think Rob hit on something too, you know, legitimate complaints. I think that whatever the process has to be, we have to ensure that it's fair and that it is not used as a political weapon, so that there would need to be checks and balances on those things, so that it could not be used against one member, against another, or those kind of things. But I think a legitimate process is something certainly that is needed, and these claims and allegations that have been brought forward by Senator Erica Smith, I think we should all be watching that very closely to see how this does proceed and where the process may be able to get better. So, yeah, as Rob said, I mean, we've seen flaws in it in the past, but here's another opportunity to look at it. So I think as these things go on and we're all watching what's happening at the General Assembly, this is one that we should watch. And I think also to have real penalties in place, that when there are allegations of this, that not only are the claims taken seriously, but that the repercussions from that and the response and punishment when appropriate is carried out, so that there are repercussions to this and some accountability that's in place.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy that weekend.
Y'all take care.
Thanks, you too.
A portion of our conversation can be heard on the radio, 4:50 Friday afternoons, during All Things Considered on 91.5 FM. Thanks, as always, for subscribing to the WUNC Politics Podcast. We are glad to have you along. Next week, make sure you keep an ear out for a conversation with Jonathan Feltz. He's a North Carolina political strategist, and that will be dropping on Tuesday. Hope you enjoy that weekend. We'll talk to you again soon.